Man, 1 Samuel, guys, this is a transition book. It's going to transition us from the period of the judges, which is 450-ish years, where God was dealing with Israel in a very unique way, unique in that men did what was right in their own mind, okay? God is allowing largely men's own consciences to kind of determine the moral path that they take. And by the way, it's a bit of an experiment, not on God's part, but he's allowing the people involved to realize, it took 450 years, I suppose, but to come to the conclusion, your conscience is not morally upright enough to determine a right and moral path, okay? I can reason with my own conscience. I can deceive my own self, actually. So if you're just kind of allowing that, you know, good angel on the left shoulder and the bad angel on the right shoulder type thing to determine what your day looks like, it's not enough, is it? We need a perfect law of liberty. We need the Word of God. We need the very Spirit of God to convict us from the inside out. And so the period of the judges was absolutely a period of just death and destruction and judgment in a very real way. And by the way, if God didn't raise up these judges, these heroes of Israel, there'd be no Israel to read about beyond that time period. The enemies of Israel certainly would have had their way and invaded and made the nation of Israel a past tense thing. God very mercifully and patiently throughout the time of the judges would raise up these heroes. And they're kind of sprinkled throughout that time. What we see now is a major shift in Israel. We're actually seeing a governmental shift. We see what was a theocracy where God led and ruled very directly and very specifically to more of what we understand as a monarchy, right? Where a king is ushered in. The people are calling for a king. And that's what 1 Samuel is all about. And here's the interesting part, to me, anyway. I know I use that word a lot, trying to expand my vocabulary, but it is very interesting to me, however. At the same time God allows a king to come to the center stage of Israel and starts to use a human leader in terms of their civil responsibilities and their civil affairs, at the same time he anoints the first prophet of Israel. Okay, if we're going to start doing a different form of government, if we're going to start allowing a man to lead in this sense, and a centralized government that you see from this point forward, actually, all the way to the time of Christ and the destruction of Israel in AD 70, then there must be a man that I speak directly to, that provides accountability, confrontation, truth. Very interesting. From that, I would suggest that God is saying to you and to me even, you know, submitting ourselves to any level of human government, there must be a prophetic aspect to that. There must be a part that you and I hold in terms of responsibility to hold that government accountable. Do you understand? That there must be a part on our level where we speak for God and we remind the kings of our world, the governments of our world, what does God say about all of this? Because the majority of the kings in Israel, as we're about to read in 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and 1 and 2 Chronicles, did what was evil in the eyes of the Lord. The majority of them did what was evil. That's where you come in. That's where the prophet comes in. That's where you sense a responsibility. Okay, the kings of our world are doing what is evil in the sight of the Lord. Therefore, it is my responsibility to resist and to confront and to speak forth the truth of God's word and to remind these leaders of ours that they have a leader who they are subject to. And in my opinion, my humble opinion, that's where the church has gone wrong. That's where the church has gone wrong in these modern days. It kind of allowed this separation of church and state thing to happen. And I'm telling you right now, the enemy of our souls says, oh, perfect. That's so perfect. The only people who know the truth, the only people that are compelled to speak the truth, the only people left on the earth with boldness and righteousness and really a moral compass or moral grounds to stand on has somehow been convinced in these latter days to be silent. To be silent. And we've convinced ourselves it's more spiritual even to be silent. And to just take a very passive, let the world go to hell, I know Jesus kind of approach. But I just want us to see, in parallel, as God raises up a king, he raises up a prophet to put his finger in the eye of the king. And that's a really, really good thing. That's safe for everybody. So as you have been given a prophetic witness or a prophetic responsibility, I'm just asking you to prayerfully consider how God would have you use that, okay? Something to think about for sure. A silent prophet is fairly useless, truthfully. So here we go. Samuel chapter 1, 1 Samuel chapter 1. Now, there was a certain man, ready for this, of Ramathaim Zophim. I don't have to read that again. Of Mount Ephraim, and his name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Elihu, and the son of Tohu, and the son of Zuth, an Ephrathite. So we have his whole genealogy there, his whole family tree, which is very helpful if you want to study this out. And he had two wives. The name of the one was Hannah. The name of the other was Peninnah. And Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. This man went up out of the city yearly to worship and to sacrifice unto the Lord of hosts in Shiloh. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, the priests of the Lord, were there. Let's pause there. A couple of things to see. First of all, we're introduced to this man, Elkanah, and he had two wives. And you might have the mindset, if you're new to the Bible or skeptical, I don't know, I think I basically know everybody, but there's a few newer faces, at least to Wednesday night. And you may have the mindset that if it's in the Bible, it's permissible from God's perspective. A lot of people do have that mindset. In fact, I've found it fun over the years in a discipleship process to ask somebody, what does somebody mean when they say it's biblical? This or that is biblical. And it's actually shocking how many people say, well, for something to be biblical, it has to be in the Bible. And boy, that just couldn't be further from the truth, okay? For something to be biblical in terms of a practice that's justifiable or a practice that's condoned of God, it actually doesn't have to just be in the Bible. It has to line up with what we call sound doctrine, good teaching, okay? Because there's a lot in the Bible that is not biblical in terms of something that I would embrace in terms of a lifestyle, right? So don't get caught in that trap. Just because you see it and read it in the Bible doesn't mean God's okay with it. Man, that has so many implications on just bad reasoning. Take this to the bank, guys, and understand this. If you're new to the Bible, this is a record, a true and accurate record of history, specifically the history of Israel. And aren't you glad? And it actually brings, you know, validation to the truth of this. God does not airbrush this book one little bit. He doesn't glaze over the problems. He doesn't airbrush the scabs and the wounds and the sin and the evil. God gives us the account as it happened under his inspiration, under the inspiration of his Spirit. And you're going to read things in the Bible like Solomon had 1,000 wives. And and I don't mean this insultingly, but it's a simple and shallow individual that would read that and go, then what's wrong with a couple of extra girlfriends on the side? You didn't read that book very well. Because with the 1,000 wives that are mentioned, or with the two wives that are mentioned here, clearly in the law, this is forbidden. What did Jesus say? He said, from the beginning, it was not so. This is God in the flesh speaking, and he's giving his strong opinions and even his authoritative position on marriage. He says, the two shall be one flesh. That's God. This is God's intention for marriage. The two shall be one flesh. Not the 25, definitely not the 1,001 will be one flesh. So there's clear prohibitions. Do not multiply unto yourselves wives, it says in the law. So be clear on that. And every time you do see a polygamous relationship, a man with multiple wives, God's word is super faithful to always present with that all of the problems that created in the family, even generationally, the problems that result from that. So it's important that we understand that, okay? So don't fall into that trap. Slavery's in the Bible, therefore God's down with it. Polygamy is in the Bible, therefore God's down with it. No, God's down with you seeing how real history played out and all the problems that happened in this world when people disobeyed the clear commandments of God. This is no exception to that. Does that make sense? So we got to know better than that. We got to understand better than that. So this man Elkanah, he did. He had two wives. One was fruitful, one was not. Hannah, who kind of steals the show here in the narrative, she was not fruitful. She did not have any children, at least up to this point. Here's something that can be confusing. This guy Elkanah seems to be very faithful in terms of his worship of God. Every single year he went to Shiloh, which, by the way, was where the tabernacle was held. He was faithful to offer sacrifices to the Lord. But I should tell you that behind the scenes, we have a very compromised culture right now. Just because the Jews are faithful in the area of ceremony doesn't mean they're faithful at all in their heart. And I think this polygamous relationship is part of that indication, actually. So Elkanah, faithful in terms of his ceremony or his ceremonial adherence. But he obviously had some things wrong. Verse 4, when the time was that Elkanah offered, he gave to Peninnah, his wife, to all her sons and daughters, portions. These would be the fellowship offering or the peace offering. Very quickly, you would bring an animal, you would offer it before the Lord, and then you would share portions of that with your family in the presence of the Lord. And it was about having a fellowship or a peace with God, and you're thanking him for his provision. So Elkanah was faithful to do that. And then it goes on to say this. He gave them all portions, but, verse 5, unto Hannah he gave a worthy or a double portion. For he loved Hannah, but the Lord had shut up her womb. Yeah, some problems in this culture. First of all, in that culture, and maybe in ways in our current culture, people misunderstood it. Barrenness as God being against. You're going to see very clearly God wasn't against Hannah at all. In fact, God had a very profound plan for Hannah, where through that womb, actually, he was going to raise up a deliverer for Israel and, like I said before, the first official prophet. God is going to allow the nation to transition. And Samuel has a very, very key role in all this. I'm kind of ahead of myself. But Samuel is the son that will eventually spring out of the womb of Hannah. God's not against Hannah. He loves this lady. He has such a precious plan for her. But you see how we can perceive things sometimes from our cultural limitations? We can make some assumptions. Maybe you're here this evening and you have less than perfect bill of health. And it's really easy. It's really easy when you look around and see healthy people and blessings. It's really easy to come to the conclusion, God, you're against me for some reason. You're punishing me for something. And I'd like to remind you, my New Testament brother and sister, all the punishment for sin was effectively dealt out 2,000 years ago on a cross. That's the truth. He bore our punishment for us. That's not to say God doesn't discipline and chasten his kids. We might get bent over God's knee from time to time. Please don't misunderstand me. But you know exactly what I'm talking about, the condemnation that can set in because something in our life is less than ideal or less than perfect. Be careful. Be careful. Sometimes God's timing, often God's timing is very different than ours. That's certainly the case here, guys. Certainly the case here. So Hannah has a wrong idea about what God is actually doing behind the scenes, and she is just absolutely beat up about this. So was the family around her. In order to kind of pacify or to make her feel better about her situation, you see Elkanah offering her more meat than the rest of the family. You know, husbands in the room, sometimes we think we can fix things that are way deeper than what we're actually able to fix. And hear this, and I don't mean to be mean, but this knucklehead of a husband is like, you can't have kids, and I feel real bad about that, but have some extra meat. You're welcome. That's just the kind of guy I am. And this man has this idea that, you know, somehow giving this lady flowers or throwing an extra paycheck, buying her what? Buying her out of a grief-stricken state or trying to offset her situation by, you know, throwing money at it. It just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And it's only the shallow ladies that would convince this man that it is working, because they want material things, actually. But they're not getting any happier. Money can't create happiness. Money certainly can't remove an afflicted conscience or a broken heart. And this is so typical of men. Wish I could do something more for you, but have some money. Have something materially speaking. Boy, I promise you, all that did was complicate the situation, because that extra portion in the eyes of the other wife created a furious jealousy. And it created a very bitter and angry rival wife. We'll see about that in just a moment. Look at verse 6 with me. And her adversary also provoked her sore, for to make her fret, because the Lord had shut up her womb. So if this wasn't sad enough, this other wife, Peninnah, was constantly reminding Hannah of her barrenness and being quite cruel. And listen, I feel like I could speak plainly on Wednesday night, because this is family. Everybody can be cruel. Sinful people can be cruel. Ladies, outside of the, you know, conviction of the Holy Spirit, can be particularly cruel. That's the truth. Unsaved women, man, that are vindictive, are some of the scariest people I've ever known. Because they have so much passion, they have so much behind their words sometimes, it can be quite cruel. And this lady, Peninnah, would just absolutely bring this woman, Hannah, to a place of just absolute distress through her words, through her mockery, and through her beating her over and over again verbally in light of the situation that she found herself in. This is an intense scene, actually. It's really easy to skirt over it and read it fast, but there's a lot going on here, you know, domestically speaking. So, provoked her and made her fret, it says, because the Lord had shut up her womb. Verse 7, and as she did so year by year, when she went up to the house of the Lord, so she provoked her. Therefore, she wept and did not eat. Hannah at this point is absolutely sick at this situation. Then said Elkanah, her husband, to Hannah, why weepest thou, and why eatest thou not? And why is thy heart grieved? Listen to this, ladies, and just put yourself here. Am not I better to thee than 10 sons? Huh? How's that, girls? You know, I don't get this, Hannah. Help me understand. What is your problem? I mean, you don't have any kids, but you have me. it seems that Hannah is a kind of a tight-lipped, kind person, because I'm married to a Hannah that might have said something at this point. Yeah, about you, Mr. Peninnah lover. Mr. Throw me a steak and think it's going to fix everything. Yeah, about you. But again, doesn't that typify men? Doesn't it? You got me? But she didn't even have him, did she, ladies? She didn't even have him. His love and devotion was divided with another woman, and clearly there's a sexual relationship with this other woman because there's kids involved. So this woman would actually be in opposition to that statement. No, I don't even have you. I have all of this difficulty in life. This woman is just mocking me behind the scenes constantly, reminding me of all this lack of God's favor, and I don't even have you. That could take the sting out of it. Elkanah, if I had a faithful husband who loved me, and commune, but I don't even have that. You think you're going to fix the problem by just throwing me a gift? Do you see the point? And it just so typifies man in our frustration. Here's what the scriptures say, brothers. Dwell with your wife according to knowledge. We actually don't have the right to throw our hands up in the air and go, I can't figure her out. We actually don't have that out. And yeah, at the same time, there's going to be a mystery in that lady that you're married to, brothers, for the rest of your life. She's not ever going to think like you. She's not supposed to think like you. She's actually much more depthy than you. She has the capacity to feel. It's actually quite beautiful, and to learn and understand that for the rest of your life is actually a great endeavor. To know our wives and make it our business for the rest of our life is a great thing. I had the privilege of being with some of your kids this morning at the homeschool, teaching a class with our co-op, which is, it's a blast. But in the, like, I don't know what you call them, but the devotions in the morning, I guess we're going to call it a chapel service. You know, Mrs. Stimler was asking the kids, what is something that you know a lot about? And I don't always have to talk, but I'm always tempted to. I love learning. I wanted to raise my hand in the class, like, Lisa Dudley. I know a lot about Lisa Dudley. And then she goes on to talk about how, you know, we know a lot about something that we love. And the kids are saying baseball, you know, hunting, whatever, all these different things. And I couldn't agree more, man. I love that lady, Lisa. And that is what's compelled me, actually, to want to figure her out and want to know her. 25 years into my relationship, there's still a lot more to learn, apparently. She reminds me quite often, didn't nail it this time, dude. Not even in the ballpark. Oh, you know, you hear the big bang in the background, but going to press on for another day. But hear this, brothers, hear this. It is absolutely our God-given responsibility and duty to know that lady, to figure her out, to seek to understand. And my experience, and it's just my experience, I'm no expert, but just communicating to my wife that I want to understand her does a whole lot, actually. It does a whole lot. But the eye roll, I can't figure you out, I never will. Boy, that's going to be something, unfortunately, that she's going to carry on her heart for months. There's a lot of things we do as men that create lasting wounds. It takes a lot of work to undo those things, actually. So to be real with our wife and say, you know what, I'm having a hard time understanding that, but I want to understand. Please, I don't want the conversation. Please don't start. Hey! The door slams. 1, 2, 3, 4, knock on the door. Can we please continue to talk about this? That chase, which annoys us because we don't get it, because we men, we cut to the chase a lot different. Could throw them a bone once in a while. That's just a suggestion, ladies, but that's for a different Bible study. You could help him out and just say, I meant this. Oh, but I know. It's the chase, right? It's the chase. And brothers, learn to love that chase, man, because when you finally catch her, it's a beautiful thing, actually. You don't give up on your job. You don't give up in chasing that big buck with all them horns, which you can't even eat. The back straps you ought to be after. But anyway, I'm just throwing that out there. You don't give up chasing a lot of things, brothers, but you give up chasing the most precious thing that God has put in your life, and that is your bride. Don't give up chasing her. Figure her out and make it your lifelong goal. I'm telling you, that is the call to marriage. And this guy, Elkanah, he's a chump. I don't know if that's a good Wednesday night. He's a chump. He really is. There's not a lot of guts in this guy. There's not a lot of fortitude in this man. He's just like so many of us, who just throws his hands up and, I can't get you. Oh, that's great. Great timing, dude. I'm sure she really appreciates it. You know what's sad about this whole narrative? There never does seem to be a repair in that relationship. From this point on, the narrative kind of switches, and guess where Hannah finds her solace and her comfort and her passion and her love? It's with God himself. You're the only one that gets me. You're the only one that I'm going to run to and fall on and pour out my soul to. Because this shallow husk of a man I live with just isn't worthy to hear all that I have in my heart. But God, you are. You're worthy. Anyway, something to certainly stew on. Aren't I enough? Aren't I more to you than 10 sons? So Hannah rose up after they had eaten in Shiloh, and after they had drunk. And now Eli, the priest, sat upon the seat by a post of the temple of the Lord. And she was in bitterness of soul. That's the result of Elkanah's leadership. It resulted in a wife that was in bitterness of soul. And prayed unto the Lord and wept sore. I don't know if you can relate, ladies, but That's what she resorted to. She went before the Lord. By the way, I would recommend that. I would recommend that, ladies, if you're in a situation where things aren't okay in the home, man, go before the Lord and just bear your heart and soul before Him. He so desires to spend time with you. He will never tell you He's too tired. He'll never tell you He's too busy. He always makes time for His daughters. That's the truth. And she goes there, and she just absolutely pours her soul out before the Lord. And she made a promise there. It says in verse 11, she vowed a vow. It's been years of praying this prayer, but at this point, she's like, this is it. I am so desperate. I'm going to make a promise before the Lord in His presence, in His house. Here's the promise. O Lord of hosts, that's Lord of armies, if You will indeed look on the affliction of Thine handmaid and remember Me, and not forget Thine handmaid, but will give unto Thine handmaid a man-child, and I will give him unto the Lord all the days of his life. There shall no razor come upon his head. That's really intense. You know, this says something about Hannah's character that actually inspires me. And that's this: I don't want a child for me. I want a child for You, God. Wow. This is the opposite of a helicopter mom. This is the opposite of a mom who just hovers over and controls. This is a mom who wants to produce a child for the glory of God and for the service of God exclusively and solely. You give Me a child, and I'm telling you right now, I will make sure that child is weaned, and I will drop him off at the temple. He's Yours. That is so intense to me, and that says something about parenting, guys. Let me just throw this out there. Ask yourself in your heart, all you parents in the room, what is the purpose of parenting? What is the purpose of it? Sometimes I wonder in my own heart and in my friend's heart, is the purpose of parenting opportunities for our reputation to kind of be exemplified and exaggerated in our community? In other words, are people going to see things in the accomplishments of our kids that we're hopeful will reflect positively on us? Do you know what I mean? And here we are, we're reproducing little work ants and little boys and girls that are going out and just awe the community and all their accomplishments, and that's just going to come back in a way that says, wow, man, what a family. Or do we more have a biblical mindset that looks like this, guys? You can read about it in the book of Malachi. God talks about marriage and the purpose of marriage to produce godly seed. And I know that's my heart. It's been my heart for the very beginning, truthfully. I've told my sons this. I really don't care what you make for money. I really don't care if you go to college or not. I don't care if you pump gas. None of them have chosen that path. It would be much smarter if they did than what they are doing. But if you would live for Jesus Christ, mission accomplished as far as I'm concerned. For His glory, for His cause. Really? And that the whole point of parenting actually is to release those kids to the world around us and not to hold on to them as long as we can, but get them out there, man. Get them involved and give them a taste that the Lord is good. And then, like it says in the Scriptures, you know, an arrow that is released from a bow, you don't chase the arrow. You let it go into this world, and hopefully it hits the mark. That's all I can do as a parent, man, is show them where the mark is. You can lead a husk to water, but you can't make it drink, right? That's the truth. And that's if we can hear this without hearing it like a passive, hands-off approach, we're managers as parents. We are managers of something that actually belongs to God. And it's up to them. It's up to them to put to practice what we've instilled in them, truthfully. I see this in Hannah. I see her coming to this place where, you know what, Lord, it's not about the years. It's not about the scrapbook. It's not about all of the opportunities to sit with other moms in the community and have the stories to share about, you know, graduating kindergarten and graduating eighth grade and, you know, making the three-pointer at the buzzer. I'm giving up all of those mommy opportunities. I want a child for You. Would You do that? Would You do that for me, Lord? It's very counter-typical motherhood, isn't it? This is quite a radical promise that she makes the Lord. All right, you get the point. I'm so inspired by that. There's such a selflessness in all of that. She's weeping and making this promise before the Lord. And then it tells us in verse 12, and it came to pass as she continued praying before the Lord, that Eli marked her mouth. You know, she's not praying out loud necessarily. She's just moving her mouth. Just moving her mouth. She's praying in her spirit. She's praying in her heart and her mind. And she's, you know, her cheeks are soaked. She's weeping, the scriptures say. Now, Hannah, she spake in her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli thought she had been drunken. And Eli said to her, how long will you be drunken? Put away the wine from thee. You know, before we look at Hannah's response, guys, how foreign was true and desperate prayer to the high priest of Israel for him to look at something so sacrificial and so Holy Spirit driven and so inspired? How drifted is the nation for the high priest to not recognize true and authentic prayer and blame it on intoxication? You know what that tells me? It has been a long time, maybe never in Eli's lifetime, has he seen true, passionate, and desperate prayer in the house of the Lord. This might be the very first time he's like, wow, there's something authentic going on there. He thought this lady Hannah was three sheets to the wind. And he rebukes her. Hey, woman back there, this is not a bar. Get out of here. Take your drinking elsewhere. And how offensive that would be. Imagine putting yourself in her position. This is the spiritual representative of Israel. And you are at your lowest, man. And you're making deals with God. You're so desperate. And the high priest rebukes you for being drunk. Talk about church hurt. Talk about church abuse. You know what I mean? She could really take this and run with it. Cause some problems. But here's what Hannah does, which says, again, a lot for her character. Verse 15 says, Hannah answered and said, no, my Lord. Man, that's so respectful. I don't know if you're, no, my Lord. I'm trying to picture the women in my life that I love very much. I'm trying to picture them in this situation. I'm not sure they would say, no, my Lord. They'd say no, but I don't know if that would be the next word from their lips. But she says, I am a woman of a sorrowful spirit. I have drank neither wine nor strong drink, but I have poured out my soul before the Lord. Count not. Don't consider your handmaiden as a daughter of Belial. Please don't look at me like some heathen woman. I don't think so. That's not what's going on here. I haven't had a drop to drink, I assure you. Out of the abundance of my complaint and grief have I spoken from this point, or up to this point. You know, Eli responds to that. It's very interesting to use an awesome word. He says in verse 17, then Eli answered and said, go in peace, and the God of Israel grant thee thy petition that you have asked of him. Listen, guys, I think personally Eli realizes, what? That's real? That was legitimate and passionate prayer? I'm telling you, it's been very rare that he's seen this. Maybe, and I'm suggesting, this might be the first time he's seen something like this in his career as priest. And I think he's making an assumption, probably a fair one. If what I am observing right now is real and authentic, how could God not respond to this? You know what, lady? I assure you, you're going to get your prayers answered. I've never seen prayer like that in all of my life. That's what I'm suggesting is going on. And he uses the name of God, the God of Israel, grant to you your petition. You know, she took that. She took that from the Lord. Because check this out. In verse 18, she said, let thine handmaiden find grace in your sight. So the woman went her way and did eat. And her countenance was no more said. She was lifted up by this. Do you see how she received this word from the priest as a promise from God? And she gathers up her things, and she's basically like, oh, thank you, thank you. She goes and has a good meal, and she's just, there's a peace that comes over Hannah at this point. She doesn't know the timing. She doesn't know anything. She just has a peace that God's going to do something. You ever have that, ladies? You ever have that, brothers? You're praying about something, and maybe it's a prolonged prayer, and all of a sudden there's what we kind of describe as a breakthrough, where you can't explain it, you don't understand, but you just have a peace. Regardless of the outcome, you just feel like God has made his will known in a matter. And you're like, all right, I can move forward now without grief. Actually convince God you're going to move in this situation. You're going to do your will. That's what certainly is carrying Hannah at this point. Now let's take just a moment more and look at the aftermath. It tells us in verse 19, they rose up in the morning early and they worshiped before the Lord. They returned and came to their house, to Ramah. And Elkanah knew Hannah, his wife. That is, they had an intimate act together. And the Lord remembered her. Wherefore it came to pass that when the time was come about after Hannah conceived, that she bare a son and she called his name Samuel. This becomes our main character for the rest of the book. Saying, because I've asked him of the Lord. And the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer unto the Lord the yearly sacrifice and his vow. But Hannah went not up, for she said unto her husband, I will not go up until the child be weaned. And then I will bring him that he may appear before the Lord and there abide forever. Now, there is a mommy in there, isn't it? And you ladies probably understand this a lot better than us men. She goes, you know what? I am not going with you. Because she knows she intends, after he's weaned, to release this boy once and for all. And she's only going to see him on annual trips from that point forward the rest of his life. So one thing she is going to do is before that process happens, before he's officially weaned, she is going to treasure every single moment she has with this kid uninterrupted. I'm not traveling. I'm not going anywhere. I am going to spend every second with this kid until he's officially weaned, which truthfully was a lot later than we weaned children. It might have been closer to, 5 or 6 years old, maybe even later. I know that's weird to you. It's weird to me too. But remember, the Bible doesn't airbrush anything, just gives the account. But she's going to spend the first foundational years with that kid, and she's not going to let anything interrupt that. It's quite precious, actually. I'm good, buddy. You go do your thing. I'll be right here. I'm not going to that temple one more time until it's the last time that I offer my son as a servant to God. Verse 23, and Elkanah, her husband, said unto her, do what seems thee good, and tarry until you have weaned him. Only the Lord establish his word. So the woman abode and gave her son suck. She nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she had weaned him, she took him up with her, with 3 bulls and 1 ephah of flour and a bottle of wine, and brought him unto the house of the Lord in Shiloh. And the child was young. Notice the child was young. He's not an infant. He's a toddler at this point, or even beyond. They slew a bullock, and they brought the child to Eli. And she said, O my Lord, as thy soul liveth, my Lord, I am the woman that stood by thee here, praying unto the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord hath given me my petition, which I asked of him. Therefore also I have lent him to the Lord as long as he lives. And he shall be lent to the Lord, and he worshiped the Lord there. So she came good with her vow. She says, here he is. Here's the one I was praying for way back all those years ago. You remember? Because I know you've never seen anything like that. You've never seen a mommy pray like that. And surely you remember me. This is the answer to that prayer. The last thing I'll leave you with, guys, is just the timing of God. And I'd ask you just to chew on this and think about this. Even as you lay yourself down. What we assume is God not answering prayer. What we assume is God not answering prayer. There were years when Hannah assumed, you're not answering this prayer, God. You're not doing anything. I've been begging you. What was God doing? Actually, God fully intended to raise up a man that would be a huge blessing to this nation, that he would use mightily. But he was allowing circumstances to grow in the nation of Israel and the culture to worsen, actually, deliberately, and he's allowing Hannah to come to a desperate state. Why? So that she would indeed honor her vow and release this child. Imagine if God would have answered this prayer 5 years prior to this, 3 years prior to this. She would have given birth to this boy and say, "Thank you, Lord," and raise him like every other mom, right? But God has a plan, a consecrated plan for this young man. So before we assume God is not answering our prayers, there actually might be a lot more behind the scenes that God knows about and is doing than we realize in our limited understanding. It comes down, once again, to trust, doesn't it? Trust to his timing. I look at our nation right now and think, "Lord, why aren't you moving, man? Why aren't you reviving? Why aren't you changing? Why aren't you convicting?" And I have to settle on the fact that it's not that God is not answering prayer, but I am confident personally that God is allowing things to brew behind the scenes, bringing us to a place of perfect timing where we're going to see, that's what you were doing, God. Thank God you didn't do it prematurely. Thank God you didn't pounce when all of this would have fallen apart. Praise God. Glory be to God. You know more than we do. Something to think about. Something to chew on, for sure, about the timing. That's as far as we get.